Hey, everybody. I don't want to take up too much time with a long-winded introduction because I'm very excited about today's episode. My guest today is Stuart Luth, who is a producer, an actor, just an all-around great guy. I've known Stuart for years, and you know, when we were both struggling actors, we would have gigs together, and I remember there was one gig that took us to Salt Lake City, and neither of us had ever been, and you know, we would have to, you know, do things during the day, and then we had a lot of downtime, and it's weird. Other people in our group, they just wanted to hang out in the hotel or get room service or go to the bar or whatever. And, you know, Stuart and I, we just kind of explored. We walked around, and I didn't have my plant-based diet then, but I was open to veganism, and Stuart was, you know, he was vegan. And so he explained to me, he's like, look, there's some places I want to check out and some places I want to eat. Are you okay with that? And I was. And there were all these little great little journeys. But it wasn't just the food. It was just that camaraderie. And, you know, we would walk and look at the different sites. We went to a Mormon, you know, that big giant temple. And I think we walked into a wedding, which was kind of scary because this big Gandalf guy kind of approached us. Anyway, it was just these little moments of just, you know, being with a great human being that to this day I cherish. And it's been really reflective. So it was very exciting to sit down with Stuart after all this time, because I hadn't seen him since then, I don't think. Maybe one other time, but it's been years. So it was very exciting to sit down and catch up with him. He is truly a remarkable person, and I just love his perspective on life. So without further delay, the Vandaltron Curious World podcast episode with the truly remarkable Stuart Luth starts right now.
Don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
The Curious World podcast, our buddy Vandal over there.
You want a podcast? Great. We have some audio on your website that nobody goes to.
You're listening to Vandaltron's Curious World podcast, all day, all night, baby. Check it out.
No stars in the sky. The night seems so dark.
You were in the middle of telling me this crazy story. Well, not crazy. I should say a beautiful story. And I had to interrupt you. We both mutually said, like, wait a minute. Like, I think this is something that should be shared. So let's back it up a little bit.
Sure.
And so you were saying that there was something special that happened in this apartment.
Yeah, man. That's right. So we moved into this apartment a little under 2 years ago. And 2 weeks after we moved in, my son was born here. And it was really a magical experience. I know that more and more people are having home births nowadays. But it was...
Well, let's back up for people listening about the process. Because, you know, you and I were kind of... then we were still corresponding. You were like, I have to move out of this current place.
Yeah.
We're getting poisoned. And I was like, what? Or the walls are falling down. And I just remember then, like... Hey, by the way, I'm a dad. It's like, what happened?
All right, so let's back it up. My wife and I were living in a small apartment in a townhouse on the Upper West Side for 5 or 6 years. We're really, really happy. And then the owners decided that they were going to go single family on it. So we had to move out. Everybody out. And we ended up finding what looked to be a beautiful one-bedroom apartment on 88th Street that quickly revealed itself as a lemon. There were so many things wrong with this apartment. It was incredible. You know, when you're looking for an apartment in the city, you've got to jump on it right away. You can't take your time as if you're buying a place. The rentals will disappear like that.
When you leave, you see the next couple coming in.
Exactly, if they're not already in there. Yeah. So it was beautiful. we saw the day it went on the market, and we put in an offer, and it was accepted. And the owners had let this magnificent apartment just absolutely go to pot. They lived down on the first level of the brownstone, and it was magnificent. Their home was magnificent. And the book,
like pre-war?
Oh, pre-war. It was built in 1895, I think. Big bay windows between West End and Riverside. Really, really gorgeous. And when we saw the apartment, we said, oh my God, it is stunning. But almost as soon as we moved in, we started realizing it was like the money pit. All these things
I was going to say, I was going to reference
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah. All these things were wrong with it. When we closed the shutters in our bedroom, which were beautiful, original wooden shutters that you see in these brownstones, the ceiling started falling down. It was scrape against the ceiling, and chunks of the ceiling would start to come down. We said, okay, well, that's not really that big of a deal. Then we started hearing this strange sound in the living room, and we moved in the summertime, and it was really warm, and the air conditioning was on, so I was like, well, maybe it's the air conditioning. But then even when the AC wasn't on, we'd occasionally hear this sound, and I was like, God almighty, that sounds like buzzing, doesn't it? Well, lo and behold, there was a bee's nest existing in our living room wall. Another small issue. He said, all right, well.
Yeah, but you're advocate of nature, right? You're like, oh, this is really nice.
That's right. Bees are our friends. What would we do without bees? Exactly. I don't even have to go outside. I can experience this. Yeah, my wife was less keen.
So how far along was she at this point?
So Viviana was, she wasn't pregnant yet. She wasn't, yeah. So we're backtracking a little bit. She wasn't quite pregnant yet, though we were thinking about it. Yes, thinking, but not yet pregnant.
I was just trying to gauge the stress level.
Oh, yeah, sure. Pretty low. I mean, we were definitely disappointed to leave our home of many years. But stress level was not too high, but getting higher every time we started noticing these things wrong with the apartment. The kicker, and I'm skipping probably five or six major things that I've blocked out at this point, but the kicker I'll never forget. We were cleaning the bathtub about a week or so into our living there. Viviana was cleaning it, and she said, isn't this weird? All this white is coming off onto my sponge. What's going on? We discovered that instead of re-glazing the tub when it needed glazing, the owners just decided to paint it with white house paint.
White out on the tub?
Oh my God. So you would take a shower and bits of paint would show up in between your toes. It was nuts. And so we asked them, of course, to properly reglaze it. Instead of hiring a professional, they had their handyman do it. It was all wrong. We said, forget it. We got to get out of here. So we left after 2 months. We ended up finding another apartment, and we were feeling pretty desperate at this point because we needed to get out between the bees and the paint. And landlords who really could not understand that the issues that we had were normal. They thought that we were crazy. And one of the challenges of renting in this city, and maybe in other cities, is if you put up any kind of fuss, you can find yourself on a list. And then it can be hard to rent an apartment down the line. So you swallow your pride a little bit and you do what you need to do. Unless it's outlandish and then you make a case. But as bad as it was, we said, all right, we're just going to go. So we ended up finding an apartment literally sharing a wall with where we started on 87th Street. And it was a lovely little space. Turned out there were some problems there too. We discovered that the person living before us had bed bugs. So then we had to deal with bed bugs for months at a time.
How'd you find that out?
I guess we were getting bitten, but neither of us was allergic to it. So we were seeing blood on our sheets. That's what it was. We were seeing blood on the pillowcases. And Viviana was like, you're always scratching yourself at night. Now you're getting blood all over my Pottery Barn.
You beast.
You beast. Cut those nails. Stop scratching. Well, it turned out, of course, it was the bed bugs. So then you're dealing with that. Even though there weren't very many, it's still a huge process. And nobody wants to go through that. So we went through that. And also, the brick wall in our bedroom would periodically crumble into our bed. And that was because of all the construction that was happening next door from the apartment that we were asked to leave. It was just one crazy circle. So after a year, Viviana had gotten pregnant at this point. And we said, do we really want to spend another year in this place with the walls falling down and also very challenging landlords on a 4-flight walk up? We said, no, let's move up in the world. Let's see if we can find a place that's a little bit nicer. With
less hazardous.
Less hazardous to our health. And we did. We found a wonderful apartment. It took a lot of time to get the approval, though, the board approval, because it's a big building with a board. And at this point, Viviana was 9 months pregnant, ready to give birth any day, and we're still waiting for the board approval. We had been accepted by the owners. We were assured from everybody, from the brokers to the concierge at the desk, doorman, whatever it's called, that we're going to be in, no problem, no problem. But you can't really make arrangements to move in until you get accepted by the board. And the days are ticking, and the days are ticking, and the days are ticking. And now we're at the end of the month, and we have to move out of this apartment tomorrow, and we don't know if we have anywhere to move to. And we're calling the broker. Oh, we're trying to reach the board member, and maybe he's away, and he's not answering his emails. And I've got to go and rent a storage unit in case we don't get that approval in time. And Viviana's going to pop any second. And everybody stresses out the door. And we had hidden the fact that we were pregnant from the new building and everybody involved because we had been discriminated against.
Yeah, I was going to ask, Are they allowed to ask?
I don't think so, legally. I think when somebody shows up and they're obviously pregnant, then you don't have to ask. But they will ask how many people are going to live in the apartment. That's fair to ask. What's not fair to do is say, well, we're not going to give you this apartment because you're pregnant and you're going to have a child. And for whatever reasons we think, that's unacceptable to us. Whether it's the kid's going to make a lot of noise or whether it's...
So how did they get that information from you from before?
When we looked at the earlier apartments, Viviana just came to the showings.
So
the broker just saw the pregnant lady.
Right.
And so they'll never tell you they're not giving you the apartment. But we historically had never had a problem getting an apartment before. We have great credit, blah, 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 all that stuff. But we kept getting no's, and the no's were, oh, we're going to go with somebody else. But that somebody else wasn't even there in some cases, hadn't even materialized. We would see the apartment continuously on the market afterwards.
Oh, I see.
So we had hidden the fact that we were pregnant this time around, and it was so tense. And
did they ever ask about her? Like, where's your wife?
I think I said she was on a business trip. Yeah, she's very, very busy professional. And she's on a client visit, sitting at home watching Frasier. Long story short, we did get the approval, but it wasn't until the moving truck was packed.
Wow.
And the driver was sitting in there and saying, where am I going? The call comes and says, okay, you're approved. And we just drove down the street and moved in. It was literally down the street. And we got in, thank God. But then Viviana's still going to give birth any day now. And so there's a lot of tension in the air and a lot of stress and a lot of anxiety. Because
boxes everywhere.
Boxes right? everywhere. Mother-in-law here helping us, of course, helping us. But, you know. Well, 2 weeks later, Oren was born right here at home. It was beautiful. We had a midwife, midwife's assistant. We had a doula helping us, all very strong, powerful women. I got to be a part of an experience that has been unchanged.
Yeah, what exactly did you do? Did you have like a clipboard? Did you like have like pom-poms? Right. Like, Viviana, you can do it. I mean, it's like the movies. It's like, breathe, breathe. Like, shut the fuck up.
There was indeed some of that. There was, you know, Van, we took a class, a natural childbirth class, an 8-week class given by this woman, Tanya Wills, at her company, Manhattan Birthing Center. And that's what encouraged us to do a home birth. We weren't thinking of doing a home birth. We just knew that Viviana wanted to have a natural birth because she does not like medication and she wanted to experience it to the best of her ability.
So she didn't receive any kind of meds?
No.
Wow.
That's almost never going to happen in a home birth. I think occasionally they might give you some Pitocin to help occasionally, but
what was the information that you found out that convinced you to do it?
Well, at the root of it, when you're giving birth in a hospital, you are a bit of a number. The staff in the hospital normally has the best intentions, but there's a lot of pressure on them in terms of it being a business, in terms of insurance issues, in terms of so many patients coming through the door. And what ends up happening much of the time is that women are rushed. Women are rushed through the process. They're given drugs that they don't necessarily need. In many cases, they're given C-sections that are unnecessary because the doctors don't want to wait. One out of three women in this country gets a cesarean, which is nuts. It's a major, major surgery that is unnecessary in many cases, obviously.
Oh, you're saying because of the time frame. Like,
let's move this along.
We need the bed.
Exactly.
Wow.
We need the bed. There's so many little things that we always see in the movies, the women lying on their back giving birth that way. That is not a natural way to give birth. Women give birth that way in the hospitals because it's easier for the doctors to examine them that way. When a woman is giving birth in a natural setting, she is either lying on her side in a fetal position, she's squatting, maybe she's sitting on a chair, but she's not lying on her back. Then you don't have gravity helping you.
Hmm.
There's so many little things that we were learning about it. And at the end of the day, Viviana said, well, let's do this at home. There's no reason why we can't. I'm not sick. That's another part of it too. When someone goes into a hospital, they're immediately treated as a patient. There's something wrong with this person. They're under our care as someone who is sick or has some sort of disorder, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And I'm exaggerating a little bit for emphasis, but just the very fact that somebody's in a hospital, the way our mind starts thinking a little bit is, well, this person's a patient. This is a patient who's a sick person. They need drugs. They need constant attention in terms of poking and prodding and doing all these exams. There are so many things that happen to a pregnant woman in a hospital that are, by most measuring sticks, intrusive and unnecessary. And they're done in some cases to justify the hospital's existence, in other cases to give education to younger doctors who are coming through. And that's all well and good, but Viviana really didn't want to be poked and prodded when it wasn't necessary.
Nobody wants to be an experiment or a learning tool.
Yeah. So we decided we'd have it at home. And we had a wonderful team, midwife, doula, and a midwife assistant. And I had learned a lot in this class in terms of being able to provide some counter pressure for Viviana while she was laboring. I had worked with, we have a friend who's a wonderful acupuncturist. His name's David Frohm. He and his wife, Rebecca, have an incredible practice in New York and New Jersey, acupuncture and Rolfing, which is an incredible myofascial manipulation that can restructure the body. Maybe you know what Rolfing is. Yeah, you do. Cool. So David gave me a whole number of pressure points written out in diagrams and everything where I could help Viviana at the different stages of labor. Literally, like pushing on a certain part of her shoulders could help not just help with a contraction feel better, but help the baby move. I thought it was mind-blowing.
Wow.
Yeah. So I felt like I was really participating in a lot of the labor. And I had always had this joke with her that when you give birth, honey, I'd love for me to be right behind you, like you laying on me, so that when the baby came out, he wouldn't know who was the mother and who was the father. He'd think we both gave birth to him. Wouldn't that be great? And we're
doing equal work.
Exactly. Equal pay for equal work. Yeah. You
know. Wait a minute. Did the building know?
No, we didn't tell the building. You don't have to. Believe it or not, it's still legal in this country to give birth at home.
Yeah. There's so many stipulations in buildings, right?
Yeah.
Like if you change a paint pattern, you got to get like the board approval.
That's right. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if there was some bylaw that said, oh, you really should say something. But no, we did not. And fortunately, it's concrete. And apparently nobody heard us. She wasn't even very loud. She really wasn't. She was laboring really intensely. She just went very deep within and was very deliberate, I would say, with the birth. We were going to do a water birth. We had ordered, or we had thought we had ordered, a little pool to fill up and have her do that. Because a lot of people, when they give a birth at home, they like to get in the water because it's gentle. But we had forgotten to hit submit when we were ordering it on the website. So we're like, damn, where's this freaking pool? All right, it didn't come.
Is it just like a kiddie pool?
Yeah, exactly. We're going to fill it up. So it never came. And it didn't matter. She, for almost the whole thing, she just labored side on her side on the bed, just going through it with me giving her a little counter pressure on her lower back. But to go back to the laying behind her and who's going to, who was the mommy and who was the daddy? At the very last stage of her labor, when she was pushing, something made her, it may have been a suggestion from the midwife, decide to sit on a chair and push that way, just kind of push down on the chair with her legs. But she was having a little bit of trouble staying on the chair and pushing and doing all those things together. And without even thinking about my whole idea of being behind her, I said, honey, let me, why don't I sit on the chair and you sit on me? And that way we can be stable and I can help you that way. And she ended up giving birth to Oren, sitting on my lap on the chair. And I was holding her stomach and I felt him slip out.
Wow.
It was beautiful. And he,
I mean, was it like, when you say slip out, like what is that? Is it as instant as you just described, or is that like a process? Did you speed that up?
It really felt instant. I mean, of course, he was moving the whole time. You're, the whole process of the labor is getting the baby down throughout. Like our midwife compared it to putting a key in a lock. Mm-hmm. The baby is finding his way down the path. But at the last stage, when the baby finally comes out, that did feel like a whole rush all at once. I felt a whole lot of movement from her stomach just come under and then slip out. And then the stomach went down and there was our baby, not only with his eyes open, but still in the sack.
Wow.
He was born in the amniotic sack, which was magical.
I've never heard that.
It doesn't happen very often.
Do you think that being home had a lot to do with that? Or?
I do.
Or not being medicated?
Not being medicated is part of it. And the other part is that we were talking before about the hospitals feeling a need to speed things up to get the next people in the bed. A lot of times what will happen is the doctor will sweep the waters for the woman. They will break the waters in advance of when it might have broken by itself. Or perhaps not have broken, to try to speed up the delivery. For the same reason that they'll give Pitocin to speed up the contractions, or they'll do other things to help make it go faster, they'll sweep the water to help the delivery go faster. And so while it is very rare, I've forgotten, I think it's 1 in 70,000 births or something that it happens in America. I think it would be less rare if that procedure wasn't happening regularly in the hospital. But it would be rare anyhow, and so it was pretty magical for us to see. And that's where his name comes from. His name is Oren, A-U-R-E-N. And it was like when he was born, there was an aura around him. So that's where it came from.
That's amazing. Wow. What were some myths that you said, like, oh, that's not that, I was kind of expecting this and then didn't happen.
Huh? I was expecting a lot of screaming and a lot of pain, and that didn't happen. There was one stage of the labor that was a little bit painful for Viv because she was, I think, being coaxed or coached to be a little further along than she was. There was a little bit of a miscommunication briefly between her and the midwife, but briefly.
But I feel like that's something that, I mean, it's like a new experience, right? Oh, I mean, that's something that's bound to happen, right?
Bound to happen, I think so. Yeah, exactly. It was her first birth. So you have a very experienced midwife saying, well, maybe this is happening now. Right. Perhaps you say, okay, yeah, maybe it is happening. Oh, wait, no, maybe it's not happening. Yeah. But she had a good experience. It's interesting. Because we live where it happened, there was for a time an element. I hesitate to use the word trauma because it was not a traumatic birth. But it's very intense, the experience. It's very charged and very intense. And so this new apartment, our new home, was suddenly colored by this very intense experience. And while it was wonderful and magical that this baby was born safely and happily into our home, it was still a lot to process.
You guys hadn't even unpacked it.
Exactly. If you look at the pictures, you see all the boxes around. Yeah, exactly right.
So what is it now? When you said it was kind of like the environment was kind of framed by that moment, is it still, or is it kind of, has it kind of transformed into, because he's grown?
Right. I think it has transformed, definitely. As we've moved from the postpartum period and we're now, he's almost two, it's now the home where we jump on the bed and where we make smoothies and where we run around and where he pisses on the floor because he's potty training now. So it has transformed for the good. Yeah.
That's amazing. That's a...
Most of the myths that we learned about had to do with the myths of home births, misconceptions that many, many people have, that the medical industry has and to some degree perpetuates, because they do not make money or as much money when you have a home birth, when you don't have visits to an OBGYN, when you're not going to the hospital for a day or a couple of days. So I learned so many misconceptions, people thinking that home births were dangerous. They're just as safe as doing it in a hospital. By many measuring sticks, they're more safe because you're not getting medications. You're not often getting unnecessary surgeries.
I would imagine, too, from a kind of just a holistic point of view, like you're in this environment. You don't have the smells of a hospital, those bright lights, people coming in and out, looking like poking you like some like slab and then looking at a chart and then leaving. I would imagine. Yeah. Like, you've sold me. This just sounds so much better.
I think so. Yeah, I think you're right on. The fact that you can be in your home and you can be eating what you want, and you have the temperature where you want it and whatever music you might want or not, you have whatever you need and whatever you don't want is not there, goes a long way.
Did you guys play music?
No. Viviana's very sensitive to music, and she just wanted the quiet. She had such a internal experience. She just wanted it quiet.
Are you the same way?
Not to such an extent. I'm remembering now, looking up the lyrics and singing last night, the Rainbow Connection to my son, and weeping all the way through it while Viviana laughed at me. I say I'm not as sensitive to music, but maybe I am. Yeah, we're all sensitive, and we're discovering how sensitive Oren is. He has a Curious George book where George gets bitten by a crab and gets this little ouch. It's just one page, and then it's forgotten about on the next page, and he's playing with the penguins and saving the day. But now, if you get to that page, Oren wants to jump over it, because the first time he read it, he burst into tears at poor George.
So how do you handle that as a parent?
So yesterday I was watching as Viviana explained to him that you could get hurt from any animal or from any person, but we don't want to do that. The animal doesn't want to hurt you. Another person doesn't want to hurt you. But sometimes things do happen. But that doesn't mean that that hurt will stay there forever. It can heal in this way or in that way. And we have to remember that people almost always have good intentions. And we should honor that.
That's right on. And the crab probably is just being a crab.
Just being a crab, exactly. The crab wanted to say hi to George, and its pincers were a little sharp for little George, and so it gave him an ouch. But he just wanted to say hi.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, that's a good segue because, ever since I've known you, you've been plant-based diet, and I kind of told you, you know, on my way up here, that's something that I kind of converted it in my own. But I mean, I'm sure you've experienced this in your dialogue. People always want to know why. Like, if you're not drinking, why? Or if you're not in like the norm, it's like, why? Which I'm comfortable. Like, I'm actually very proud of like the choices that I made and everything like that. And for me, you know, it takes steps. You know, I think if you kind of like dive into something, I think that's just kind of almost like emotional, which is fine. Mm-hmm. But then maybe you burn out. And so for me, it was something that it was a gradual, and really it started for me was just compassion. Like, I love animals, you know, I have two cats, and, and then, you know, I started volunteering at this, Tamberland Farms, which is outside, like out in New Jersey. And it, and the most compassionate animal on the farm was this rooster. And the rooster was like, it's no different than my cat. So all these dots started connecting for me. And so the crab story just kind of reminded me of, like, you know, how I kind of see things of, like, just in terms of empathy and compassion. And I always, I relate it back to animals, but I also kind of reset myself in, into humans too. And so one of the, one of the main reasons why I wanted to talk to you is, like, you are one of the most compassionate, empathic, very thoughtful and insightful people that I think I've ever met.
Thank you.
And all my travels, and, you know, and all that, and, you know, even though we work together in, like, these kind of compressed times, they've always been quality for me. And I want to know, like, what is your, you know, what is your moral compass? Like, how do you see the world, and what, you know, what's kind of like your light, especially in times where, like, you do get stressed, whether it's like moving and, like, you've got like 5 minutes to tell the van driver, like, how do you kind of reset and say, I'm not going to flip out. Or maybe you do. And then that's okay too.
Sure. Yeah. I think we all fall down sometimes. And for me, there's been a lot of work around being okay with that. Trying to be non-judgmental on myself when I don't live up to my own expectations. That's something I've been exploring a lot recently, realizing that in those times where I don't measure up to my own yardstick, as arbitrary as that may be in certain circumstances, trying to not beat myself up for choices I made or behaviors that I engaged in, and trying to forgive myself and move on and make the next compassionate choice, whatever that is. I do believe that mostly everyone is trying to do right and trying to be good the best way they know how. And it has taken me some time, but I recognize that when people live differently from me, if they're not following a vegan diet, for example, or if they're smoking cigarettes or doing something that, that I would personally not do and don't like or approve of, recognizing that they're making, at this moment, the best choices they can make. And I see myself as, when appropriate, a guide for people that may be looking to make different choices, but also realizing that not everyone is looking for that right now. When I went vegan 8.5 years ago, it was the right time for me. If people had talked to me about that previously, I don't know how I would have behaved. I really don't know. I was a different person then.
You also, you avoid gluten as well, right?
I do. I have developed a little bit of an allergy to it. I say a little bit. If I eat it by accident, I get really depressed.
Wow.
It's funny.
Yeah, it is. I've been reading a lot about how certain foods are linked to our mood swings.
That's interesting.
You know, somebody, you know, a diet with a lot of fruits and certain fruits, I forget which ones, but like strawberries can like really heighten your mood. And obviously if you eat a lot of, well, there have been a lot of studies that, you know, if you eat like a lot of food that's like cooked in animal fat, you become aggressive. And you know, I'm sure that's debatable, but what I'm saying is that's, there's a point to that.
Right. Right. Yeah. So I do avoid gluten. I've avoided gluten probably for seven years now. And the list of foods that I avoid keeps increasing, as the list of foods that I go to keeps increasing as well. I have not eaten soy in the last couple years. I am avoiding canola oil because canola oil is very harmful to the body. as I learn more and more, I'm finding ways to refine my diet more and more, and I feel better. I just feel better. I am not ethically opposed to having a glass of wine or a beer or a cocktail or anything, but I personally feel better if I don't have anything at all. And so I haven't had a drink in a while. Maybe I will next week. Who knows?
Hey, let's do it.
Hey, let's have one now. But I feel better when I don't drink. So I don't drink. All these little things. If I don't eat chips, I was noticing if I have some potato chips or something, right away my stomach would start to hurt a little bit. So why would I put myself through that? I take that out of my diet. And as I refine more and more with what I'm eating, my body is giving me feedback faster and faster. Mm-hmm. It's almost instantaneous. I'll put something in my body and I'll know right away if it's good for me or not. And fortunately, at this point, I've gotten into a pretty good swing with what I eat, that nearly everything I eat feels good.
You know what's amazing is when you start doing that, when you start fine-tuning your body like that, your body will start giving you signals of like, and it'll start changing your cravings.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It's funny how suddenly you're craving certain vegetables or fruit, craving spinach, craving avocados.
I was going to say, like, I could eat avocados all day.
Yeah.
But then the socially conscious person in me starts thinking, going down that rabbit hole of like, okay, so now there's an increase of everybody wants avocados. So then in Mexico, they start, demolishing certain areas so they can grow avocados. What about those other plants? What about that other, that labor force?
Yeah.
And
you, like, you go right down and you just can't do everything. You can't take care of the whole world. It's too hard and it'll drive you freaking crazy.
Okay. So that's what I want to focus on. Like that's kind of micro macro, but like in the micro level, and things like things that just, that piss us off on the day to day, whether it's an acting job that you wanted or some kind of emotional response that you wanted or you didn't get from somebody or some sort of a level of disrespect,
right,
that we all encounter. I mean, how do you neutralize that? I mean, because, most people are like, well, fuck him. They meet force with force.
Yes. I think we're encouraged to do that a lot in society.
Especially as men.
Especially as men. Yeah. Just look at any superhero movie. We fall right into the, Superman. Yeah, whoever it is, beat him up. Kick the shit out of him.
Well, I'm guilty of in those movies that like the Taken franchise.
Oh, sure.
Like his family gets wiped out. Yeah. And so like the middle-aged man has to like wipe out like the terrorist group.
That's
like,
right. Yeah, and it appeals to something very strong in us. It really does. But you have to ask yourself, at what point is that not healthy? Yeah. I go back, Van, a lot to the Bhagavad Gita, to making the effort, to doing the work, but throwing the results away. The world is too big and too crazy to always get the results that we think we want. And that's part of it, too, the results we think we want. And the more that I can remind myself that there really is no end goal for so much of life, the whole point is being happy in the present moment. And if you can throw away the need to get some results that you think you want, I really do think that happiness will be more attainable. So I try to remind myself of those teachings quite a bit. Sometimes it's a little bit out of reach, no doubt about it. I have been working a phrase into my conversation a lot recently that a mindfulness teacher named Alan Locos talks about, which is, let me think about that. That's very interesting what you just said. Let me think about that. As opposed to jumping in with my point of view, jumping in with my judgment, jumping in with no, it shouldn't be like that. It should be like this. I've read all these things. I've lived in this way. I know better. Okay. That's your perspective.
Yeah, it's ego, right? Oh. I encounter this very often. And especially, and this, I think most people encounter this with relatives.
Yeah.
because even though it's weird, right? You grew up in the same house or you have the same bloodline, but it's like, whoa, we don't think the same way. We may look the same. We don't think the same. We don't even communicate the same.
Yeah.
You know, I have a brother who has gotten super religious. Mm. I guess I'm agnostic. Mm. I'm spiritual. I'm actually a student. I try to learn from an academic standpoint about religions.
Mm.
But I don't, I have problems with ideologies, mm-hmm. but that's me.
Sure.
He's going whole hog into it. And so our communication I can't discuss things pragmatically with him because anything is an insult, you know, if I don't agree with him. So mm-hmm. it's like, I can't talk to you anymore. And then he gets even more offended. And I'm like, look, you need to, you shouldn't be this emotionally attached to anything because we can't have discourse. You know, either I agree with you or I'm completely against you. I'm your enemy. And it can't be like that.
No.
You're wrong. All right, here we go.
Yeah, it's such a danger to fall into that black and white. And that is a theme that I have been working on for myself for a long time because I can fall into perfectionism a lot, which is very destructive. It's been very destructive for me in times where it's held me back from doing something simply because I'm afraid I'm not going to do it perfectly. And I have been holding on to this notion that either it's perfect or it's shit. And if I haven't put all the steps together to make it perfect, then I shouldn't do it because, well, God, I don't want shit. And that's
the parable of the artists, by the way. Mm, many artists feel that way.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, you're right about that. And so much of it has been on an artistic level. So that black and white dichotomy has been something that in a lot of ways I'm trying to refine for myself and realize that life is one big gray area. It really is. And that's where we're all on the same playing field. And that's where we need to meet each other.
But we live in a world that cultivates ambition. Look, I mean, you know, the extreme is, you know, people showing off and wearing high-end clothes and promoting a certain lifestyle. That's the extreme. But I think anything that we award success. I mean, you know, we don't live in a commune.
Right.
So how do you juggle that with, you know, we need to be ambitious in this world in order for us to achieve not only monetary goals, but our goals that are the things that are important to us spiritually and emotionally. So how do you balance that aspect of, like, you really need to get it in gear and be disciplined and, you know, pull up your bootstraps to what you were just describing, this grayness?
Because
that's something I struggle with.
Yeah, I think that's an ongoing struggle for me too, Van.
So what are we doing? We're just struggling.
The balance of putting in the effort but throwing away the results, but also needing some results to make a career, to have enough money for your family. That's hard. It really is hard.
Does it change?
What has changed for me is that having a child has done what I think it does for a lot of people, which is given me a kick in the pants and said, you want what's best for this guy, don't you? You want to be able to give him every possible opportunity, everything that you can. And so I have wanted to do that. And the initial impulse, I think, sometimes is, well, I got to make a lot more money.
Mm-hmm.
I got to do that. And then something interesting happened for me, which is that I lost a whole lot of my income soon after he was born. And Viviana had been laid off 2 days before she gave birth from the company she was working for, which is a whole other story. So we went from having a decent income to having very, very little income with a small child.
And boxes everywhere.
Boxes everywhere.
The bees were like, how you like me now?
And it took me some time to get here, but I'm immensely grateful for what happened, which is that this change in job stuff, change in income, has allowed me to spend a whole lot more time with my son. Is it sustainable forever at this level? No. I've been working more and more, and I will continue to work more and more, and that's going to pull away a little bit more and more. However, the fact that I was able to spend so much time with him at an early age, where we have been able to get so close that it's a situation where I really am a co-parent. We're in, and it sounds funny because I am a co-parent, but in so many families, it's not that way. There's one parent who has spent much more time with the child.
Right. The hunter-gatherer paradigm.
Exactly. Or in this culture, you've got two hunters and the gatherer is a nanny.
Yeah.
Which is so common. And that's not to point a finger at anyone, because as we were saying, society is requiring more and more. You make more money and more money and more money. And a lot of families have felt the need to have both parents working. And we may fall into that as well at some point. We're transitioning. But I really am grateful that I have been able to make this bond with Oren. I've been reading studies recently that show that time spent with the father early on carries forth for the whole length of the relationship, as long as both of them are living. So as hard as it's been for me economically, and as hard as it's been for the family, it's been invaluable.
Mm. How does it affect your judgment, your morality, even from an artistic level?
In what way?
Friends that are parents or have a life-changing situation, for better or worse, you know, they say like, oh, I don't want to watch this particular movie anymore because of XYZ or whatever it may be, right? Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, now my grandfather had a heart attack last year. Now I make sure to give my seat on the subway to an elderly person. What I'm curious about is, has this affected the way you see not only the world, but the your artistic viewpoint as well?
Hmm. It does open you up so much more to how the world seems to act in spite of the fact that there are children around. Walking down the street and witnessing various types of behavior, now I take a step back and say, my goodness, but there's children. There's children right there when you threw that cigarette 5 feet from him, or when you were screaming at your own child, or what have you. It does come with a shift. You become, at least I've become, more sensitive and more attuned to how fragile the child's world is. And what I mean by that is, you can put any kind of input into a child and they're going to grow with that. I'm watching my son, for example, learn Spanish, learn sign language, because we've been signing with him, which has been amazing and the best advice anybody
gave. Is it the same in both languages?
No, American Sign Language we're doing.
Right.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Yeah, like, come on, guys. We can't agree on this one. We all have hands. It's different in Spanish, right?
Yeah, we haven't even looked at that. So no, we've stuck with this. Right, we do all have hands. It's hilarious. Watching how what you put into a child, how you feed him, how you water him, is going to affect his growth for good or for ill. Just becoming so attuned to that, thinking about the way I speak in front of him, thinking about, like you said, about if we're watching movies, if we're watching television, we've been doing almost no screen time. We've been talking about how do we introduce that? What is it okay to introduce him to?
Oh, you mean he doesn't watch TV?
No, not yet. We've done a couple little videos of counting and I've shown him a number of sign language videos so he can see some signing, that people signing better than I do. It has made me more thoughtful in a number of ways, I think. Certainly, the more I learn about nutrition, to go back to that for a moment, the more excited I am that I'm giving my child an opportunity to have good, clean foods from the very beginning.
Yeah, you said, so he's got little buddies now, right?
Yeah, he does.
And do they have, like, birthday parties and stuff?
Yeah, he's...
So what happens if he goes, like, what's that? That's a chicken McNugget. Like, right. Dad, like, what can I put that in my mouth?
Yeah, so far the way I've handled that is, that's the kind of food that some people like to eat. We don't really like that food so much, Orin. We've got, maybe when we get home we can have some blueberries, or we could have some potatoes, right? You like potatoes. And then he starts hopping around. So it's going to be interesting to see as he starts to develop more independence, and we'll be in environments where we'll not be there, because so far he's not had any child care outside of the house, or he's not had a nanny, or he's not had daycare or anything like that. So yeah, we're going to be jumping into that and seeing what happens. And I think part of it is not being black and white about that too, and relaxing a little bit, if like, okay, he wants to have, you know, some chips that I wouldn't give him at home. Maybe that's okay. I would say it's not okay for him to have a hamburger, but if it's going to be some chips or something, then maybe I can give a little bit.
Yeah, I think maybe the key is just don't make it taboo, because obviously kids that, like, don't do this, like, I'm going to show you. It's like, you know, like the big, like, big neon sign for them. I think maybe there's that. But also, I think this is generally speaking, obviously somebody who doesn't have kids, and I think I'm kind of echoing where you're going, is just making them responsible little people. And I think, you know, if he wants to have chips, it's something that he says, that he weighs the pros and cons. Because ultimately, we should all be doing that, right? So if people want to engage in me with about nutrition and food, I'd say, because I had a coworker once who said, pretty recently said, you know, we were talking about, you know, I kind of outed myself of, like, you know, what I ate. She goes, I love chicken, but I can never, like, I can't look at raw chicken, or I can't think of it as, like, an actual animal. I said, okay, well, and so I'm going to push back, because this is my core. Like, you talk about a sports team, I'm like, yeah, whatever. I was like, okay, well, you're not being truthful. You're not being honest with yourself. And she's like, what? Like, no, I mean, look, you're an adult. You can put anything you want in your body, but for your own sake, I mean, you should read the label. I mean, you should know what you're doing. Own up to it. You're getting a Purdue chicken. It's had a horrible life. It's been a battery. It's been gutted and sliced, and it died a horrible death. And you fried it up and you ate it. I'm not saying that I'm not judging you, but I want you to know that. And if you're okay with, just embrace it, and that's fine. Like, live your life. Because not knowing or refusing to live in a world of ignorance, that is kind of the root of so many problems that we have, right? Yeah. And so that's what I try to, how I try to live my life, and how I try to, like, keep going inward of, why am I doing this? You know, with that quote that you just said, like, well, let's kind of unpack this. Mm-hmm. A word that I kind of ring to that kind of echoes in my head is maybe. Like, okay, well, it's this way, but maybe it's another way. And I try to see other perspectives, and I try to be as informed as I can about things. And what I find difficult for me is sometimes the intellectual and the emotional don't line up, you know, and you know, obviously you try to keep them in line. So I think I've been very good about kind of neutralizing that impulse of, you know, going from like 0 to 60 and like wanting to choke somebody. Like, that's probably not going to happen. But I think where I struggle with is, you know, living in the gray that we were talking about, of like, it's okay. Just, I have to remind myself that, like, you know, I'm kind of in the water, and there's no lifeboat. I've got my little boat. I'm in a lifeboat, but there's no like rescue boat. Mm. It's okay. Just relax, and it's okay. I have to, like, for me, I just kind of say like it's all right.
Okay.
You know, one note my mom used to always tell me was, and she was a Buddhist. I don't know if this has anything to do with it, but she said you don't have to be aggressive to be strong.
Mm. Mm.
And I ignored that for most of my life until recently.
Yeah.
But it's so true because I was the opposite. I thought like I need to be aggressive to be strong, but it's the opposite. And that's what I'm kind of learning of, like, just being more like, if we're on the subway, I don't know why I keep referring to the subway platform. I guess that's kind of like the baseline denominator, but if like you like push me, I guess the natural impulse is to at least address that.
Yeah.
But I think it's so much stronger to just look and just to be an adult about it, right? And just like, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that's Jesus's example, right? Turning the other cheek. As hard as that can be in the moment and as frowned upon as it seems in our society to ever just allow that to happen, that really can be the most powerful response. Yeah.
So what are things that are important to you as, you know, where you are in your life, artistically, mm-hmm. spiritually?
Meditation. Recognizing that with a 2-year-old running around constantly, it's not always going to show up as a traditional sitting on the floor meditation, the same time, the same place every day. Allowing myself to find ways to meditate when I can, if it's just a couple minutes here, a couple minutes there. And that might mean just pausing and resetting and finding the breath, even if it's just 10 or 20 seconds, having a little micro meditation. Doing those throughout the day helps me. Being outside, being in nature. I found this winter that I didn't spend the time outside that I normally would. I think a lot of it had to do with what I was doing with job stuff, getting up to speed with something that I've been working on for a little while. But I was feeling parched. The word that keeps coming to mind. I needed nature. So now, even if it's a very busy day, I'll just go up to the roof. Our building has a roof, and just look at the sky just for a short while, just to feel that, just to reset, bringing Orin into nature now more and more. We did that a ton when the weather was good. And now as it's starting to get good again.
Has he been on like trips? Has he gone to like Bear Mountain and stuff?
Not yet. I need to get a hiking pack that he can be in on my back, because they, at this age, they can't just hike on their own. And in the young baby carriers, it's just not tenable for a long period of time. So that's something that we're going to get, something that he can be on my back and hike around. We were in Central Park the other day, and we're on a little path, and we're going to go to the swing set where he usually goes. And then he turned to the other side of the path, and he started to sign mountain. You know, it's the sign language for mountain. And it was this little rock formation. And I saw that my son wanted to climb this mountain, not just go play on the swings. And I was elated. And so we climbed on this little mountain, and he found some rocks that he was discovering the shape and the feel of. And he saw some moss for the first time and was poking away at it.
You let him get dirty?
Yeah.
That's good.
Dirty. Yeah, it feels good. And kids at that age especially, they need that kind of stimulus. They need to explore in that way. We learn so much through our, is it the tangible sensation? I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. We learn a lot more. We remember a lot more. When it comes to memory.
Is it kind of kinesthetic?
Maybe that's
kinesthetic learning.
Yeah. The what we learn through touch and through smell are so much stronger than what we see and also what we hear, which is counterintuitive to the way we normally live our lives, just seeing and hearing everything. So trying to plug that in for him as much as possible, and then by extension for myself, get a little dirty, I think is really helpful.
Well, they say that sense memory is really related to the power of smell.
Yeah, it's such a big one.
Because, you know, like, if you go, like, you, I remember when I was a kid and I would, you know, my, you know, we would walk, you know, walk by, like, McDonald's or something, and the, and you'd have the French fries and be like, oh my God. And I think, you know, so when I kind of like, when I start talking about like foods that people crave, I always question, like, you, do you crave those things because you ate them as a kid, or you know, and they, do they remind you of a, is it a pathology? Or do you just want those things? Because chances are you just don't want them, unless it's your body telling you.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. They're connected to memories, to feelings of home.
That's my delicate way of saying your body's not telling you to eat crap.
You don't want those nachos. You really don't. Yeah, you want the memory of them.
Right.
That had been for a while one of the only parts about being vegan that I was finding difficult, which is very specific foods that remind you of home, or when you are home and they are having that very specific food. I've been on a quest recently to recreate for myself in healthy ways as many of those things as I possibly can. And it's not that hard. It's really not. It's not. And it's fulfilling that void for me, I think, because we do want that feeling, that cozy feeling. And eating in this way is...
I read that the sensation of eating something, the taste, is only the first like two or three bites.
Ah.
And then after that, it's kind of inertia of, I'm putting this thing in, the oral pleasure.
I see. That
but let's
sense.
Say if you're craving like, I don't know, like an apple pie. Well, obviously that I'm sure that there's a lot of pathology behind that. But then like, boom, boom. And then after a while, you know, you've got that whole giant piece and you're going to keep eating it because of the sensation, but it's not
feeling that anymore.
You're done the first two bites.
Interesting. And then... Oh, that's good diet advice for people, I suppose.
Fuck that, man. I need my protein.
Another big thing.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Another big thing that we've been focusing on is health. And this has been big part of my life for a long time. Obviously, I went vegan partially because I, like many, many, many people, believe it to be the healthiest way to eat, alongside the compassionate arguments and the environmental arguments and everything else that goes into veganism. But a lot of the refining that I've been doing recently have come from Anthony Williams' work. Do you know who Anthony Williams is?
No.
Anthony Williams is a medical intuitive. Do you know what that is?
Mm.
Someone,
you're really outing me to be real dumb.
Yeah.
Hit me with another one.
So Van, he's a man. Do you know? He has a dog.
Is he like The Rock?
Exactly. Well, as famous as Anthony has become, a lot of people still don't know his work. Most people still don't know his work. It's still kind of niche, but it's so important. A medical intuitive is someone who can intuitively diagnose medical conditions going on with someone. The most famous in history is probably Edgar Cayce, who lived about 100 years or so ago. And he had no medical training. He was just a regular religious guy in the Midwest, but he would go into trances. And in the trances, he would channel some sort of high-level spirit. And he was able to diagnose medical conditions accurately for everybody around him. Anthony has this skill as well, combined with another skill. Not only can he tell what's going on with people, but he knows what the remedies are. This started for him when he was 4 years old. He was sitting at dinner with his family. His grandma was there. Everybody's just having a dinner like normal. When he heard a little voice in his ear say, go walk over to grandma. He says, okay, why not? He goes, walks over to grandma. Then the little voice says, put your hand on grandma's chest. It's like, put your hand on grandma's chest. And he does. And then the voice says in his ear, now say grandma has lung cancer. What? He tries it. He puts his hand on her chest. Grandma has lung cancer. The whole family chills. Everybody's freaking out because they recognize that something real is happening. Though she had never shown any signs of being sick, nothing had exhibited any problems, she goes to the doctor because this was so intense. Sure enough, there's a tumor. And from that day forward, this voice has been in his ear continuously, giving him the ability to diagnose folks as Edgar Cayce did, as many other medical intuitives do. But where Anthony's gift goes a next step is that this voice is also giving him highly specific remedies for so many mystery illnesses that we all have. And pretty much every sickness that we deal with is a mystery illness to some extent, with the exception of things that are very obviously because you ate too many hot dogs. So things like shingles, things like thyroid disorder, various cancers, multiple sclerosis, lupus, Lyme disease. I mean, all of these things. He's written 3 or 4 books at this point. His first one is called Medical Medium. And there have been so many people that have been helped by his work over the last 20, 25 years that he's been doing this. We got his first book right when it came out. Viviana and I were both dealing with certain things. We started adopting his suggestions, which all revolve around raw fruits and vegetables and very specific herbs and different types of supplements. And the shit works. He's right on. He understands exactly what's going on. He has this information that he is receiving from somewhere that is far beyond not only where medical science is, but where the holistic healing community is. And yes, it's a leap to say, I'm going to trust this. The man is not a doctor. But how are our doctors doing for us nowadays? Not very well.
If you want opioids,
yeah, exactly.
they're pretty well with that.
So we've been doing Anthony's work for a while, working now with a doctor who is trained with Anthony, who's also an intuitive, who works in that vein. And we've seen incredible changes in our bodies, in our spirit, and everything. So learning more and more about how I can get my body to a place where it feels really, really good, learning more how I can get my son or keep my son in a place where he is healthy, advice that I can give to family members, like my mother who just went through a cancer treatment, seeing that the way that we live can be passed on, not just through things that we think about typically genetic-wise, but that we can pass on specific viruses to our offspring, and what I can do in my body now to heal myself of anything that might be remaining before I have more children. It's very empowering to live as healthfully as I can. So that's been a really big...
What's his name again?
Anthony William.
Anthony William?
William, yeah. Okay. He's very well known at this point, though not widely, widely known. His website is medicalmedium.com, I guess, or .org. I don't know. You have to look. But his first book
is... I'll put the link up for people listening. And if you're on your treadmill, don't feel like you have to like stop. And like I'll put the links up on the feed. So
cool. Yeah, it's life-changing stuff. It's really incredible.
So... believe it or not, we're almost out of time. But one thing I wanted to ask you is, how has your perspective changed as a performer in New York City? Or has it?
What's changed for me, Van, is I'm recognizing more and more that so much of the entertainment business is way out of my control. As hard as I work, as good as I get in my craft, as much as I do book jobs and create a growing resume, I can't live in a place where I feel like I need that. It's too difficult. You're setting yourself up for a lot of heartbreak, I think. And so while I still do work as an actor, and that's very important to me, I have a dual career now that I've stopped thinking of as a day job. And because I love it so much, it's another thread in my work life. And that's communication coaching. I've been doing that bit by bit for a long time. That's where we met, doing some of that work, of course. But I recently started working with a company that's excellent, that is very simpatico with the way I see communication and feels really good for me to bring that kind of work into the world, to help a lot of people to communicate more clearly, to feel more comfortable when they present in whatever manner that might show up. And when I made the little switch in my head to say, I love this too. I love it. I don't have to be shy that it's not acting exactly the way that I've been doing for a long time. When I've said to myself, I feel very comfortable in my bones with that being a career for me and not shying away, the desperation that happens around the acting really started dissipating. And you know it's a killer. Yeah. And when you can walk away from that feeling, I think you can blossom. And if you choose to continue acting, if someone else goes through this path and they decide not to, wonderful, God bless them. If someone continues to do that, wonderful, God bless them. And I think that they may, at the end of the day, see more success because you're not clutching on too tightly. We'll see what happens with me.
Right. And I think it's kind of cyclical about our conversation now, where you're saying, like, really investing in yourself and kind of finding out who you are, you know. And I think that's, you know, kind of the point of the show, but like, I think the journey that we're all on, you know, and I think some of us wear these blinders of like, I want monetary success, or, you know, however I define success. Okay. What happens if you get it? 'Cause that's a danger, right? And if you're so invested in this thing, and of course, what if you don't? Is your world going to fall apart? And, you know, what I found is people who compromise and then still fail. I mean, failure is subjective,
sure.
but you know, in their eyes.
Right.
The thing about humanity is we're so fragile that we potentially can be a few bad turns from that. But we could also be a few turns away from like a great day like this.
Yeah.
Talking with a great friend and the sun's out finally in New York. So I want to end with this. So what is right now, what is happiness to you? I think I know the answer.
It's throwing my son up into the air and seeing him screaming to the point of hysterics while simultaneously signing more.
Stuart, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Van. It really was my pleasure.
As I, you know, as I said in the top of the show, you're such an inspiration to me. Even though we haven't seen each other for unfortunately years, some people leave an imprint, you know, and I think there have been times in my life where I felt like, I wonder how Stuart would feel like this. And then I do the opposite. just
always good advice.
Sweet listeners, thank you for listening. As I always say, you're a part of this conversation too. You're just on the quiet side. Bodhisattva, go out and do good in the world. And as I said, the links to, what's his doctor's name again?
Anthony William.
Anthony William, the link will be on the feed here. And if you have any questions about that, you can email the podcast. Thanks.